This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. More disturbing facts and figures are coming out about Lake County's battle against opioids. Lake County Coroner Marilee Fry spoke to the Lake County Advancement Commission at their luncheon meeting in Schererville last Friday, and I had a chance to sit down afterward to talk with the Coroner Fry. Here's our conversation, beginning with the bad news.
Our numbers have definitely been increasing in regards to our opioid-related deaths. In 2017 alone, we've had 196 overdose deaths, and close to half of those were opioid-related. As a matter of fact, 62 of them were fentanyl, and 44 of them were heroin. And we are also seeing an increase in those that overdose from carfentanil. We're just seeing an emergence of that in the last 2 years.
I know you mentioned to the folks here at the meeting that it seems that the opioid addiction numbers are going to be climbing exponentially, almost, I guess, in the years ahead before they start to fade down or even trail off any, isn't it?
Yes. The CDC and the DEA has projected over the course of the next few years that those numbers are going to skyrocket, and they're going to take off like a jet airplane before we see those numbers coming down.
You mentioned about the fact that people have ways of being able to know, or at least tell, at least that there's a problem out there with a family member, a loved one, or someone else here. Tell us about what you've mentioned to the folks here in the meeting, the things they should or others should watch for to try and find some signs or maybe some addiction problem someplace.
Well, I do know it's important for our youth as parents to make sure that we know who their friends are, where they're going, and that they're engaging in healthy activities. Some of the things that you can look for are a change in their moods or their behaviors. It's important to monitor their grades to see academically how are they doing, are they continuing to achieve the same achievements that they've previously achieved, as well as monitoring their bedrooms to see, looking in between mattresses and drawers, checking their cell phones, knowing who their friends are, keeping your eyes out and being aware to see if you notice any changes in your child.
Have you talked with people, maybe not necessarily related to being a coroner, but just being a nurse, and people that you know that have had opportunities to use some of this advice and in turn have been able to stave off the potential for somebody passing away because of a drug overdose?
Yeah, absolutely. I've talked with our emergency room nurses and physicians. I've been attending events at school. For example, this week in Hammond, I attended Hammond Technical School. I spoke with their students that are in the medical careers class in regards to the opioid epidemic and the work that we do within the coroner's office. They asked a lot of great questions. So I do think that being coroner allows me an opportunity to educate our community, to speak with those that have certainly been able to make a positive difference based on what we are hearing and seeing. And they have reported back to me that often I have met with people that have a loved one that has an addiction, and we've been able to get them to a treatment provider. But certainly it can make a difference. Not that I want to say it can be a scare tactic, but it is startling and alarming to hear of how dangerous substance use can be, and also certainly in regards to our opioid epidemic, how dangerous heroin and carfentanil are.
I know you were asked questions by many people here at the meeting, and one question was asking here why we seem to see the increase in the trend now. And you mentioned some interesting facts, I think, some historical problems that kind of had led over time to why we see the opioid epidemic right now. Tell us about those, please.
Well, I believe in the 1970s that there was heroin out, from what I understood. I was a child at the time, but I do know in the 70s that heroin was out there, but it was very expensive. And at this time, heroin is very inexpensive, and it's more accessible than it has been. And there's a couple of ways that somebody could become addicted to an opioid. Often we know that our gateway drugs are marijuana and alcohol, and if our young people use them, it certainly can put them in a compromised position where if they had peer pressure and they offered them an opportunity to use a substance like heroin, they just might make that poor decision if they were under the influence of something else. So I think nobody you know, starts out by wanting to have an addiction. As a matter of fact, I believe everybody thinks that it couldn't happen to them. Another way could be, besides peer pressure or starting out with some gateway drugs, could be that somebody may have an incident, a post-operative pain management put in place by their physician, or possibly they could have had some type of injury, sports-related or motor vehicle accident, a back injury, where a physician would prescribe an opioid such as Vicodin or oxycodone. And within a short period of time, that it is possible, especially for someone that may be predisposed to an addiction, it's possible that they could develop an addiction. It's possible it could be very difficult for them to come off of the medication, and once the physician no longer prescribes, they could look to other people, and then eventually, and that's quite costly to get those prescription medications on the street, eventually they may look to something inexpensive such as heroin so they can continue to get that opioid. And I can say that these are substances that are no longer pharmaceutically controlled. You don't know if you're getting a certain milligram dose as if a pharmacist had made the or a pharmaceutical company had made the drug. You are now getting something that a drug dealer on the street has prepared, and it could be the fatal dose.
Well, you mentioned, too, about the fact that maybe with some of these drugs now that we're seeing with the fentanyl, the carfentanil in particular, the stronger, more dangerous kinds of opiates that are getting mixed in with these drugs, it makes things even more dangerous now.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the reason for that is these drug dealers want to get them addicted quicker. They think they're going to buy heroin, and they have no knowledge of it. They're actually getting something laced with that fentanyl or the carfentanil. It's going to give them an increased type of feeling or high, and certainly it's going to make them want to come back that much sooner to buy more.
I know you mentioned to the audience here about the importance of finding ways to not get hooked to begin with, so to speak, let the addiction take hold. And you talked about the ways that a person who may have to have gone in for surgery or some medical procedure, which in turn has resulted in pain, and they may need some help. And you talked about finding alternatives to these very addictive and very dangerous, but very unfortunately very effective painkillers.
Yes, so that certainly is possible after somebody has had surgery and they're on post-operative pain management. We do know that that's not a chronic pain. That's what we call acute pain, and that prescription medication certainly can be effective in managing that pain. But we do know that there are prescriptions available that are non-opioid related, such as Toradol. That can be very effective for, let's say, orthopedic procedures and some other type of procedures. And that's a medication that you can't take for a long period of time for chronic pain medication or prefer chronic treatment such as cancer, but it can be very effective. And Toradol is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, so it works similar to ibuprofen. So certainly I think it's good that if somebody does need pain management, for them to talk to their physician and ask, are there any other options? Is there any other medication available that could be non-opioid related?
I know since you work very closely with law enforcement agencies and with the sheriff's department and the county jail on these issues in particular, you mentioned about the fact that there seem to be so many people who are either gone into incarceration or they're coming out of being incarcerated, and maybe they may have had problems before because they were locked up. They didn't get the drugs. They may have been weaned off to a point, but they'll go right back on if they're not careful. What methods or techniques are you finding or ways to deal with that?
Well, we do know that those that are incarcerated are our most vulnerable population. And with that, we recently did some research. I've been working with a new position in my office called a drug overdose analysis, and we've been looking at numbers and comparing numbers of those that have lost their life and have been coroner's cases and comparing them with those that have been incarcerated in the Lake County Jail. And just in recent weeks, we have learned that a large percentage of those that are incarcerated at the Lake County Jail that have an opioid addiction and that are released within that first year of being released, that it is very likely that they can lose their life due to a drug overdose.
What do you find that seems to help in trying to, if not to stop it altogether, but at least to be able to postpone it?
Well, I did go to our Lake County Council, and I've asked them to accept or adopt a resolution. And the resolution is a program called the Prescription for Action Program. Mm-hmm. I did a little bit of research, and I found out on the East Coast that their community leaders have put together this program called the Prescription for Action Plan. And it's a program that engages community leaders in addressing our opioid epidemic. It outlines a very good strategic plan, and one of them is addressing those that are incarcerated. So with that, we have been having monthly meetings with the Lake County Sheriff, and we've looked at how can we help those that have an opioid addiction, and are they ready for treatment? So we have identified those that have an opioid addiction. We have implemented a plan to test them with therapists to identify if they're really ready and serious to enter a treatment program, and if they are soon, in the very near future, going to be offered a medication for an opioid addiction called Vivitrol that can be injected and that will be effective for 28 days that will block the receptor, allowing an opioid to come into that barrier. In other words, if they were to use an opioid, if they have an opioid addiction, it would cancel it out, kind of like it would become canceled out and they would not be able to achieve a high, so therefore they likely would not look to that. Also, it would be an important part of their opportunity to go before the prosecuting attorney and the judge to offer it as a condition of their plea bargaining. For example, if somebody has committed a crime and they have an opioid addiction, they could possibly, you know, plead to their situation, and an important part of that plea bargaining would include that they would go through the Vivitrol program in the jail, and then once they're released, they would be on probation. They would be connected immediately with a treatment provider, and it would be monitored to make sure that they are having follow-up appointments, that they're having drug tests, and that they're remaining clean, and that they're continuing to get that Vivitrol injection every 28 days.
Finally, Mary Lee, I know it's not able to be able to stop all of the overdose deaths, but in the experience that you have and the courses and the workshops you've had a chance to participate in, and talking with people as well too, maybe with family members, what, I guess, advice or what can you prescribe, so to speak, to family members to what they should be watching for if they have family members that are having problems or have the potential of having problems that could unfortunately lead to being just another member of the opioid statistics?
Well, certainly you would see a change in their behavior. And also, sadly, you may see that they're making choices that are not good choices, such as stealing from family members. You'll not only notice that change in their behavior, whether it be nodding off or not showing up for work or that money is missing, that they're not being responsible or accountable with any finances that they have, and that they're interrupting family finances by taking from other people. So those are some of the things that you could look for. And if you notice that, it would be best to encourage them to go talk with somebody in a treatment program. Sometimes the mindset of going into a treatment program might be too much, but if you can ask them to be willing to talk with somebody, just simply make that one step. If they're willing to say, I have a problem, admit they have a problem, and admit that they would be willing to talk to somebody. Here in Lake County, we have many great treatment programs. We have regional mental health. We have Recovery Works. We have Heartland Recovery. So we have many, many great treatment programs throughout Lake County, and they're willing to help them, and whether it be an inpatient or an outpatient program, but certainly encourage them to talk with somebody.
Mary Lee Fry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been about 6 months since the Trump administration declared a nationwide public health emergency because of the opioid crisis, and many are wondering what's changed. The president says federal leaders will roll out a policy plan in the next few weeks, and as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, local advocates are hoping to see less talk and more action.
Overdose Lifeline has been at the forefront of the opioid crisis in Indiana for years. Up until recently, the nonprofit's founder, Justin Phillips, says the group was crammed into a small space with little storage.
We just, had outgrown the space we were in because we've got intern participation from both Purdue and IU, and added a staff so we could fully implement our prevention program.
The organization moved into a larger space about a month ago.
Okay, here we go.
As Phillips walks me through the front door, she points out two large rooms, a front desk area, and a spacious storage closet.
We have storage now for all the naloxone. So at one point in time, we had the naloxone off-site in a secure storage. Now we can do it here, which is so much better for us.
She says the expanded space will help them improve efforts to curb the opioid epidemic.
I hate that the need is still so big and that the problem still is really complex and feels insurmountable, but I'm glad that we get to keep doing the good work.
And still, more than 100 people in the country die every day to an opioid overdose. Drug overdoses in Indiana are growing faster than the national average. Death rates involving synthetic opioids doubled between 2015 and 2016. Phillips says we can't keep talking about the issue. It's time to act.
We don't have time. Honestly, we don't have time.
National leaders promised more action at a recent White House opioid summit. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says they've been working to increase treatment and implement prevention and response efforts. He says Trump's budget also proposes doubling state grants for those efforts from $500 million to $1 billion a year starting in 2019. Here's Azar talking on C-SPAN.
To support that grant program, we announced a new method of technical assistance in November to use more local experts and expertise to provide technical assistance to states and grantees rather than a traditional one-size-fits-all approach from Washington.
Dennis Watson is an associate professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. He says local involvement will make a difference, and Indiana needs to hold national leaders accountable.
Things at the national level, you know, they can trickle down somewhat, and they're going to states in terms of, like, policies that make certain funding available and things. But at the end of the day, it's the states figuring out how to use it.
Research shows opioid use decreased by more than 30% within 6 months for those using medication-assisted treatment, like methadone, for example. But Watson says people also need social support. President Trump at the summit suggested harsher penalties for drug dealers and even opioid distributors.
Hopefully we can do some litigation against the opioid companies. I think it's very important because a lot of states are doing it. But I keep saying, if the states are doing it, why isn't the federal government doing it?
Several Indiana counties have announced lawsuits against opioid manufacturers. While officials continue discussing the issue, Phillips says her organization is trying to move past that by implementing an online program so people can access information.
These programs, specifically the opioid public health crisis that we have, is about everyone having the same piece of information, so that we don't have to keep having the summits, but instead we're all on the same page. Community, here we are.
As she flips through a pile of thank you cards she received from ninth grade students, she says it gives her hope.
Honestly, the day you came, I was thinking of going back to doing pills. You coming really helped me see that there are other ways to deal with depression. See, that is like one potentially life we change, and I don't care about the rest of it.
The cards show her taking action is what makes a difference. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Tuesday at 12:30 local time, that is 1:30 in the afternoon in Indianapolis, people affected by the opioid crisis, public health experts and community, labor, and faith groups will get together at the State House to hold what's being called a people's hearing on the opioid crisis that has touched thousands of Hoosier families. An exhibit of protest art from demonstrations across northern Indiana was on display at a Chicago gallery over the weekend. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Algiana was there to check it out.
The exhibit titled Art of Resistance and Resilience in Northwest Indiana was organized by the advocacy group Northwest Indiana Resist. Uri Eichen Gallery, located minutes from downtown Chicago, had little walking room. It was full of visitors and Hoosier protest art. Pieces included signs against the once-proposed Elkhart Immigration Detention Center to more hands-on pieces like these.
Get a hold of those noisemakers. It is a BP oil train that they made into noisemakers for demonstrations.
That's Ruth Needleman. She's a retired professor from Indiana University Northwest and a co-coordinator with Indiana Resist. She's also a board member at URI Icon. She says when she began to plan the event, she knew it had to be in Chicago because of the shared issues the city and northern Indiana face. Needleman says the purpose of the exhibit was to bring attention to Hoosier efforts to combat what she calls injustices across the state, while promoting cooperation with similar groups in other states. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
Legislation on gun regulations appears to be close to its final form, as lawmakers heard more than 3 hours of testimony on the issue on Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith tells us about the final committee meeting this session on some controversial gun bills.
The final bill combines two issues, eliminating the lifetime handgun license fee and allowing gun owners to carry firearms into churches that are on school grounds. It's the latter that drew much of the debate in the final hearing. Barbara Manis is a school volunteer and carries at both school and church. She says it's because she wants to protect against armed people who would do harm.
If someone thinks that there might be someone who can shoot back, they might think twice.
Kristen DiBella is with the group Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. She says more guns on school grounds makes her scared for her children.
This is not ideological. This is not political. This is a mother pleading with you to help keep my children safe.
Both chambers have to approve the bill before session ends. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
This is Patricially Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. I attended a small high school called Morgan Park Academy on the south side of Chicago. I actually started going to Morgan Park Academy in the seventh grade. The reason I started going there is my father went to the public school that I was attending, Fort Dearborn. When he got there, he talked with the teacher, and the teacher noted some problems that I was having, hanging with the wrong crowd. And then the teacher asked my father if I was interested in having him go to another school. So they ended up putting me in private school and taking me out of public school in the seventh grade. I was what you call a latchkey kid, meaning you stay home until the parents came home at 2, 3 in the afternoon, and then you could go out. But until then, you stay in the house. You don't let anyone in the house. I was always told to work on homework after school. So for 2 hours after school, I would have to sit and make sure I worked on homework. But I was rather lazy and mischievous in the classroom. Just getting into a lot of trouble, a lot of referrals to the principal's office, not paying attention in class, just not really being focused on what I needed to academically. And I guess he saw something that said, hey, you know, this kid could go either way unless his parents kind of step in and do something different with him. My family wasn't an affluent family. Both of my parents were postal workers, so they worked that postal shift night and day, rain, sleet, or snow. And they put me in private school, which was a bit of a culture shock for me because I was then in a school with kids that had more affluent families, meaning they were doctors, lawyers, politicians, things of that nature. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me in the beginning because I would have to travel about an hour to get to the school, so taking the bus one way while my other friends and people that I knew and grew up with in the neighborhood were going another way was a bit of a transition. I remember my uncle used to take me to school in the seventh grade, and my uncle drove a cab. So my uncle would drop me off right in front of the school in this big old Beetle Volkswagen-looking taxi cab, and the kids would ask me, why do you drive a cab to school? And I remember very vividly telling them, my parents are so rich that they had to hire a cab for me because I was embarrassed about, you know, coming to school in a cab when other kids were getting there in BMWs and Audis and, you know, other, you know, bigger cars. And I remember an embarrassing moment, and I think my uncle caught on. I never asked him if he did. But in the seventh grade, I acted like I had a basketball injury and I was limping because I was getting teased so much about coming to school in this cab. I had him stop a little further back and told him, you know, I wanted to walk this injury off. So the biggest transition I had to make was in the academics. The real first exposure I had to what you would call honors classes, and then just the reading levels that those kids, you know, those kids were reading novels in the seventh grade, and I don't think I would have read a novel until I reached high school if I had stayed in public school. I also remember very vividly attending that school, it being more of a diverse culture. That was the first time that I really experienced going to school with white kids, kids of international nature, whether it be Indian, Korean, Chinese. So I think in a lot of ways it prepared me for coming to Valparaiso University, but my experience in high school was quite different because I would still go home and it would still be my neighborhood and I could still fit in. My friends helped me stay grounded.
You can hear more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. An organization that's based here in Northwest Indiana as well as in Illinois is offering hope to residents with cancer as well as to their families and their loved ones. Phil Zelke created Phil's Friends because of his personal experiences with the disease. In fact, he told Regionally Speaking that he is a two-time cancer survivor.
Cancer was something that wasn't really on my radar. It had not touched anybody in my family, but at the age of 22, I first heard the news that I was diagnosed with cancer, and it was stage 4B Hodgkin's lymphoma. Doctors had said I then had all the symptoms of the most advanced stage for about 9 months at that time. I delivered the news to my girlfriend. It was our two-year dating anniversary, and I delivered the news to her, but she stood by my side, and I ended up on my hospital bed for about 6 months. And during that time is really when life stood still for me. And I was able to take a look at what people did for me, kept a journal the entire time while I was going through it, not just the first time I had cancer, but also, again, when the cancer had returned later on. But I kept track of, you know, a group of people put a care package together for me, and they all signed their names to it and said they were thinking about me and praying for me, and it meant the world to me, you know, as a 22-year-old who heard the news that I was diagnosed with cancer, to know that it symbolized that care package, that I was not going to have to walk this journey alone, and it was okay to accept other people's help. And then I also had a couple individuals who sent me cards in the mail, and they came just about every week. And so I looked forward to when I was well enough to be at home. I'd sleep upstairs on the upstairs couch, and I'd struggle down the stairs out to the mailbox and open the front door and put my hand in that mailbox. And just about every time I came up, I was not empty-handed. I came out with a card, and I'd struggle back up those stairs and sit down on the couch and open it and know that you know, it was sent from someone who cared for me, and it brought me hope along my journey. And I think the big thing for me was, one, it symbolized for me, you know, what really hope was, and that's the simple thing, was getting a care packet and getting a card in the mail and having someone pray for you and someone visit you in the hospital is really the most profound things when people go through something as devastating as cancer. And it not only affects, you know, yourself, but also your entire family. And after I was cancer-free for the second time, I got engaged to my girlfriend, Carrie. Then we ended up getting married, and we have two sons now, and we're able to look at cancer in the rearview mirror. But now our whole family and our whole organization that was born, Phil's Friends, has a perspective of wanting to bring hope to people in desperate situations just like I was in. I found myself on my hospital bed. Mm-hmm. So we deliver care packages, we send weekly cards in the mail, and we engage volunteers across the Lake County area to bring hope to cancer patients in your backyard and also to different areas across the United States.
Now, Phil, tell us a bit about not only about the Phil's Friends Hope Centers, but how the Hope Centers are working with volunteers to be able to follow through on the mission and vision that you have.
Yeah, so one thing, you know, cancer is something that affects all of us. There's 1.7 million Americans that will be diagnosed this year. 1,500 Americans lose their lives every single day. And they say in our lifetime, 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women will be diagnosed with the disease. And since everybody knows someone who's affected by cancer, whether it's personally, a family member, someone in neighborhood, or someone who you know that's just an acquaintance at work, we have basically assembled opportunities for people through our Hope Center in Crown Point, Indiana, where groups of up to 50 people at a time can come in and serve together. And it could be Boy Scout or Girl Scout group, it could be a church group, it could be a corporation or a business, or just a group of friends that get together, and they come together for 90 minutes. We do this anytime during the day and evening from Monday through Saturday. Mm-hmm. And they'll pack care packages when they come into the center and then make cards for patients. And then they also have the opportunity to request a package for someone that they know that's going through it, the disease.
Now tell us about these care packages and how do the packages that the volunteers there at the Hope Center put together, how do they differ from the one that you received that kind of got the whole process started?
There's really not a lot of difference from the one that I received and the ones that we send out. The only thing that's different is I was a 22-year-old, and the items inside of that care package really spoke to me, mm-hmm. Were things that I needed while I was going through the journey. But during the entire time of my cancer battle, I kept a journal, and I wrote down what people did for me and what cancer patients need. And so we have separate care packages for men, for women, for kids, and for teens. And so there's simple items in there, like the blanket to keep you warm, or a journal, or a crossword puzzle, or a water bottle, special mouthwash for patients who are going and getting mouth sores through their chemotherapy. There's different Christian materials, such as a Bible, in there as well. And then we just, those are put in, and on the outside of the package, they're assembled, and then the outside of the box are decorated. So they show up on people's doorsteps across the United States, anonymously from our organization, but someone requests those. And then after that, they start getting cards in the mail, which happens pretty consistently about every month. We'll get a handwritten card that comes to their house. And then the other way we do that is deliver these care packages in local hospitals. And so really it's very similar to what I received. And people always ask me, when did the organization begin? We were founded in November 2006. But it was really when people supported me is when the vision came for this mission.
Would you have any guess of how many care packages have gone out here since the organization really really blossomed here in the last few years?
Since 2006, we've sent well over 40,000 care packages.
Wow.
Since our inception. And this year alone, we will be close to 10,000 to different places across the United States, as well as the hospitals inside Chicagoland. The easiest way to get connected with the organization is to go to our website, philsfriends.org. It's philsfriends.org.
That's cancer survivor Phil Zelke, the creator of Phil's Friends. Let's check in with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. First, to check out some concerns that you may have about the long-running bull market and trying to keep your head in such calamitous times. Greg, thanks for joining us here on Ridgely Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. I enjoyed being on.
Well, let us take a look here on the concerns that we have here as we've gone from the last markets now into this long-running bull market here. How long has this market been running like this?
Well, it's one of the longest in history. It's, the bottom was in March of 2009, with the prior year being the down year that most of us remember. And so it's been pretty much a nine-year run to the good.
Now we're into 2018, and it seems to be already a kind of a year of uncertainties, to be sure. So what are some of the most important things to remember as we go into 2018 and to continue watching our markets and watching our finances as well, too? Well, how about our investments first?
Well, the first thing is obviously make sure you're investing based on your risk tolerance. You know, a lot of people get caught up into the excitement of the market moving up, and you know, we could talk a little more about that. But as you get near retirement, a lot of people automatically adjust their risk tolerance based on time horizon. I always tell folks there's three things: you want to make sure you're in quality funds, make sure the allocation matches your risk tolerance, which is the biggest key, and then the time horizon. And as you do those types of things, you just want to make sure that as your time horizon shortens, you're in less volatile investments.
Mm-hmm. One thing, too, that I know that we look into when looking into options for our investments is to be diversified. That's very important, isn't it?
Absolutely. And a lot of the diversification comes from uncorrelated type investment options. Mm-hmm.
You know, what are those?
So a lot of individuals will look at markets, and of course you want to make sure your balance and allocation between equities and bonds makes sense, but there are different types of investment structures that aren't going to necessarily go up when the market goes up or go down when the market goes down. They're correlated to other things like, you know, real estate, you know, different types of commodities or strategies that are going to be, you know, more tactical in nature that are more geared towards preservation than they are making the full uprun of the market.
I know we always talk about this. It's very important to do so, but sometimes it always bears repeating that one of the things you have to be able to plan for in your life is retirement. You may never think you'll get to that point, but all of a sudden you're there.
Yes, and as you plan for retirement, I think probably the biggest thing, you know, that we can control, as I tell individuals, outside of, you know, nobody's going to control performance, but outside of performance, you know, understanding, you know, tax planning and when and how to make contributions to IRAs and or potentially look at conversions, especially with consideration into the new Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Roth conversions can be especially desirable right now for a lot of taxpayers. But a lot of that comes with designing and creating the income stream, or the, what we call the income plan, as you move into retirement that helps drive some of those decisions.
Now, since we, of course, dealing now with the tax reforms coming out from Washington, are there certain things we have to watch in particular as a result of the changes in the tax laws that pertain to our retirement?
Well, right now, I think the big advantage is, at least through the 2023, when this reform is going to be in place, is, you know, I think these are going to be some of the lowest tax brackets we'll ever see. So looking at structuring things now or taking advantage of those low tax brackets today could be very advantageous when we're in retirement to controlling, you know, the tax exposure that we would have in the future. So doing things now at a lower cost could help prevent tax implications that we would have by not doing them now.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, and among the things I know that we always talk about too when we get together is being sure that we're well informed, and that's very important, especially now, I'm sure, as we get out of this bull market and look to what the future is going to be like for this year.
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing that people, when it comes to just understanding the financing, the bull markets, any educational events that you can actually attend, specifically, there's a lot of things that are available in or around just general investment concepts, Social Security maximization, Medicare. The more you find and understand about those different types of things and the different opportunities that are available to you, the better decisions you're going to be able to make and the more comfortable you're going to be with those decisions.
One thing, too, I know that we watch on a very close basis is all of the what's been said out there, the news articles, the reports that come in on the cable, as well as what's on the Internet here. It's very important to not get caught up in the hype, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I think the biggest thing that a lot of people will come in is, you know, we've been in such a long stretch of the market that it's easy to forget, you know, what a correction actually means to portfolio and what it could do in the distribution phase. And you know, they're hearing from friends, they're hearing from family, hey, the market's hot, you're making money, things are going up, you should be in the market. Well, again, it goes back to the principles of what your risk tolerance is, what your time horizon is, and if you're not going to be comfortable with the volatility, anything that can make good money is going to have increased volatility. And ultimately, if people end up pulling out because they got in at the high part of the market, which, you know, we're at historic highs even with this partial downturn, you know, as soon as that market starts to go down, if you're going to bail, it doesn't really help you.
And I know, too, that I guess you talk about knowing what your tolerance level is, I suppose. It kind of is like, I guess, drawing that line in the sand, is it not?
Absolutely, because one of the things that we always try to have people understand, just from the natural evolution of performance, if equities are outperforming bonds in your portfolio or the aggressives outperforming the conservative, you may have started at a certain mix, and automatically that mix is going to get out of proportion because the equity sides are going to grow faster. And so people get caught up even with, hey, I don't want to sell because I'm going to pay taxes. Well, you know, it's kind of like, yes, taxes are, you need to be cognitive of it. You need to understand that there's growth that you're giving up of with reallocations. But if you don't have that line in the sand, so to speak, where you can say, hey, if things start to change direction, you know, here's my exit strategy. You need to have an exit strategy where, you know, you're going to pull some of that equity and retain those gains, even if it causes some tax implications, because, you know, that's the whole point of the investing. I think a lot of people lose sight of the fact that, well, I don't want to sell because I pay taxes. Well, if you're paying taxes, it means you did well. You made money. Don't give it all back just for the sake of not paying taxes.
Well, Greg Hammer, you know, we always talk about the important things in our financial advice, and one of the important things, I guess, we look at to the near future, at least, is making sure that our 2017 income tax return gets filled out properly, certainly, and turned in on time, and that's a very important thing coming up here. We're getting close to the deadline, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, April 17th is that deadline that's sticking out there. It's a little bit different than the 15th because of the way some of the dates fell. And you can submit an extension, but one of the things we just want to make sure everybody's aware of with the extension, it does not extend your obligation to owe. So if there's a balance that is going to be owed from taxes, you can extend the actual filing of your taxes, but they expect the liability to still be paid on time. Otherwise, you will accrue interest and penalties.
And we also talk, too, when it's time to get the returns together, talk about having everything all ready to go before you actually get the form filled out. But I guess that means the proper documents, too, don't you? Have all that lined up.
Yep, most people that are working are familiar with the W-2s, but there's still various forms and types of the 1099, which is, you know, miscellaneous income either from work and or different interests you might have received or capital gains you might have received. Or the other thing that you just keep in mind is any sales of property. You know, there's a capital gain that you need to report. There's a lot of events that, you know, occur throughout the year that are beyond the W-2. You just want to make sure you're bringing them all in.
And we talk about retirement, of course, and we talk often about the IRAs, many of them that are out there. What's important to note here as we get ready for our filing our 2017 return?
Well, I think it's as good an opportunity as there's ever been to make a max out your IRA contributions, because you can do it at a 3% higher scale than what you're going to be in this year. So to me, it's an automatic 3% savings. You know, 15s turn into 12, 25s turn into 22, and that opportunity to save at that higher deductible amount is going to prove beneficial down the road.
Now, we talk about not only getting the return ready to go to be sent in to the IRS and to the State Department of Revenue as far as the state income tax return is concerned, we also probably don't always look for what the deductions we can get the most benefit from. What are some of the top tax deductions that people seem to miss this time?
Well, I think it's going to be even more relevant, Chris, with some of the stuff with the higher deduction, standard deduction. Those folks that are over age 70 and a half and are charitable-minded, they really need to understand what a QCD is, a qualified charitable distribution, that can be done directly from the IRA and reduces their taxes above and beyond the standard deduction. So for a lot of those folks that are in that category, it could be very beneficial. And then outside of that, you know, you have a lot of things that maybe people don't naturally think of, but when it comes to planning fees, if it's non-qualified accounts, those fees, those custodial fees, the administrative fees, are things that could potentially be deducted on a Schedule A.
I know, too, we also can talk about health care costs, too. And I guess if you have a lot, then you got to be sure that you get all those deductions noted before you turn your return in.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily always equate the dental costs with medical. If people have dental work done, that is a medical expense that can be added on to other medical expenses. And generally, you know, if somebody runs into a high dental exposure, hopefully you haven't experienced it, Chris, but it could get kind of expensive when you have to have some major work done.
Well, no, I haven't had to have all my teeth replaced yet, so which is, I suppose, good, too, you know. But a lot of people do, because that's what they're talking about these days, and you see a lot of advertisements and comments out for people that want to improve their smile and other things, too, and those are expensive options, I guess, you have to plan on, too, that you might be able to deduct.
Yes. And the job research, you know, if you're looking for a job, any of those expenses that you have with it, I mean, a lot of the expenses that were there in the past are going to be there. It's going to be a little bit more difficult to maybe reach the maximums with the new limits, but you still have the real estate interest, you know, any mortgage, insurance, and property taxes. Some of the things are going to be capped, you know, with limits of how much. And that's why a lot of people might look to, you know, bunch deductions. You know, if there's things that you can pay in every other year versus every year to help increase those potential deductions to possibly get, you know, beyond the standard deduction, could be things to consider.
Well, as always, great advice. Thank you very much. We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, and we'll be back with you again soon to take up another topic.
No problem, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. On February 8, 2018, a man I will call John left an Indianapolis hospital after 4 days of not receiving the treatment he very badly needed. He repeatedly asked the hospital staff for blood transfusions, a treatment he knew he needed for his rare blood disease. He was denied the blood transfusions over and over again, and was instead offered opioid painkillers. John is just one of more than 1,000 people living in Indiana with sickle cell anemia. Sickle cell anemia is a deadly condition that affects mostly people of African descent across the world. However, it is also very prevalent in Middle Eastern countries along the Mediterranean. In the United States, around 100,000 people suffer from the disease. Sufferers are born with abnormal red blood cells. Healthy red blood cells are supposed to look like round, fluffy discs. But those with sickle cell have red blood cells shaped like the farming tool called a sickle, a curved, sharp shape like a crescent moon. Because of this shape, red blood cells do not carry oxygen properly and can cause a huge variety of complications, including extreme pain, jaundice, pneumonia, organ damage, slowed growth and delayed puberty, heart problems, joint damage, increased risk of infection, stroke, and anemia. John went to the hospital in extreme pain and requested a blood transfusion, one of the few medical treatments that actually helps patients with sickle cell. When he was refused, he left and headed straight for the Martin Center in Indianapolis, one of the first sickle cell centers in the country, established in 1969. If you live in Indianapolis, you may have heard the name Reverend Boniface Hardin, a legend in Indianapolis, who over his lifespan won so many awards and honorary doctorates that I genuinely could spend 5 minutes just listing them. He was a celebrated Catholic priest and civil rights activist who took after the late Frederick Douglass in both appearance and in dedication to racial and social justice in Indiana and across the country. He was named a living legend by the Indiana Historical Society and is probably most famous for founding Martin University, Indiana's first college specifically for Black Hoosiers. At Boniface's funeral in 2002, Pastor Kenneth Taylor spoke and said of him, "People's lives are better and stronger because of him, either through the education they got from his endeavors or through his sickle cell initiatives." But unlike other social justice leaders, he did not exclusively focus on political or legal battles. He saw how research and medical professionals did not prioritize the medical conditions of the Black community, and did something about it. In 1969, he teamed up with Dr. Raymond Pierce, another prominent member of the Indianapolis Black community, and opened the Martin Center to combat oppression, racial prejudice, and to focus on the horrible disease of sickle cell anemia. When the Martin Center, on the near north side of Indianapolis, opened its doors in 1969, it was a trailblazing institution dedicated to social justice and sickle cell anemia. At the time, the Martin Center was one of 5 such centers in the U.S. Sickle cell would start to receive much more attention beginning in 1972, 3 years after the Martin Center had opened. So, why does sickle cell continue to be a problem today? Though Indiana has protocol in place and significant funding to check and treat newborns for sickle cell anemia, adults with the disease have a grim life expectancy. Many adults with sickle cell die between 30 and 48 years old. So why is this? According to the current president of the Martin Center, Gary A. Gibson, the perception of sickle cell as a Black disease has negatively influenced the amount of funding and attention the disease has received in the past. Studies show that diseases like cystic fibrosis, which affects only 30,000 people in the United States compared to sickle cell's 100,000, receive 7 to 11 times more funding per patient. From 1910, when the disease was discovered, to 1972, when Richard Nixon signed more funding into law, research into sickle cell only got about $1 million in funding. That's not very much. And in a recent 3-year period, sickle cell disease patients had no new drugs approved for treatment, while patients with cystic fibrosis had 5. There are many reasons for this funding discrepancy, including disease advocacy and media attention towards disease. But it also does appear to stem from racism and social justice issues. Researchers from the University of Virginia published a study in 2016 that shows that implicit bias against Black Americans is prevalent among healthcare professionals. The study showed that nearly half of those surveyed believe that Black people have quote-unquote thicker skin and therefore feel less pain than white people. These kinds of biases and incorrect assumptions could be the reason that Black Americans are proven to be undertreated in our healthcare system and statistically given less pain medication than their white counterparts. In fact, a study published in the Clinical Journal of Pain shows that sickle cell patients wait 60% longer for painkillers than sufferers of much less painful diseases that primarily affect white Americans. And according to the U.S. government's Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, patients with sickle cell wait up to 50% longer for care in the emergency room compared to other diseases. And their care is so inadequate that 40% end up back in the ER within 30 days, which is worse than any other condition in the United States. Remember John from the beginning, who was denied blood transfusions to help replenish his red blood cells? John is up against quite a bit. Luckily, he is one of 400 clients of the Martin Center, who will support him in every way they can. The Martin Center is an innovative organization that combats sickle cell from every angle, social, political, and medical. In fact, the Martin Center has done incredible advocacy work. They have established relationships with medical professionals across Indiana. The Centers for Disease Control even came to a town hall meeting in Indianapolis to learn about the needs of the sickle cell community. The Martin Center also holds advocacy days, where they spend the day at the Indiana Legislature, spreading education and awareness of Hoosiers with sickle cell. The advocacy of the Martin Center is part of the reason that Indiana is one of the leading states in caring for our sickle cell population. According to Greg, Indiana is just one of a few states that have sickle cell programs written into law that ensures funding year after year, and one of the few states where testing newborns for sickle cell is standard procedure. Though awareness of sickle cell is increasing, the disease continues to lack national attention, funding, treatment, and basic awareness, even among healthcare professionals. Luckily, Hoosiers in Central Indiana can receive support from the Martin Center. As we can see from the Martin Center, social justice and science are partners, not competitors. The best way to help people like John is to fuse together STEM and humanities to push our state forwards towards a healthier, more racially just Indiana. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.